hello, geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to episode 97 of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we get into this episode, I just thought I'd make an announcement or two. I had talked in the last episode, I believe, about how I was having some distribution problems with one of my band's albums. I can't fucking remember the name of it now, but it doesn't matter, because I had aborted that album, and instead I released a 3-song single, Innocence Ends, and that is out right now. And if you haven't heard it yet, I'd appreciate it if you'd all take a listen. And number two, I've also released a new I've submitted for release a new 7-song album, Coliseum of Carnage. I just submitted that, so it won't be out by the time you guys hear this episode, but it should be out within the next week or so, I hope, as long as I don't have problems with my distributor again. It should be out sometime this coming week, I believe, hopefully. So for this episode, I thought that once again I'd do something just a little bit different, instead of talking about some terrible and good movies that some of you have probably never even heard of or seen, I thought I'd talk about some supposedly quote-unquote haunted real objects in real life. And I say supposedly and use air quotes around haunted, because even though, like I've said in past episodes, I'm really not a believer, even though, once again, I have had some unusual experiences that for no sane or logical reason should have happened, but did. And for some of those experiences, if you haven't heard me talk about them before, you can hear them back in the My Spooky Vacation episode and the 1-year anniversary episode where I talked to AK and Jerry about my doll story. But like I said, I'm not a believer personally. I just haven't, or despite those experiences, I just haven't seen enough evidence that there's some afterlife out there, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And if you believe in that kind of stuff, that's fine. I'm not here to take a big seeming shit on anybody's beliefs. I understand that everybody has to have something to believe in when it comes to death and life after death. You know, some people have their religious reasons for it, and other people just really want to believe that there's something out there for us after all this is done with, instead of just laying, you know, 6 feet under the ground. And I completely understand that. And like I said, I'm not here to shit on anybody's beliefs. I just am not a believer. They say, you know, that like hauntings or ghosts themselves happen when somebody dies either a violent or early death. And I've known a few people that have died under those kinds of circumstances. And so if, you know, once again, a ghost or spirit or whatever you want to call them is the result of a violent or untimely death, then why haven't I seen the ghosts or spirits or apparitions or whatever of the people that I have known that have died in those kinds of circumstances? No, it just doesn't really make any sense to me. But anyway, for this episode, like I said, I'm going to talk about some supposedly quote-unquote real-life haunted objects. And I thought that I'd start out with the first three, with some that are pretty well-known, and then go into the more obscure ones that some people know, some people don't. So the first object that I'm going to talk about is pretty well known, especially since memes have been made about it, and a pretty big urban legend started about it about a year or two ago, I believe. I can't really remember the timeline for it, but that object is the Hands Resist Him painting. And this is a painting that was created by artist Bill Stoneham in 1972, and it depicts a young boy and a female doll standing in front of a glass-paneled door against which many hands are pressed. According to Stoneham, the boy is based on a photograph of himself at or around the age of five. The doorway is a representation of the dividing line between the waking world and the world of fantasy and impossibilities, while the doll is a guide that will escort the boy through it. And the titular hands represent alternate lives or possibilities. I mentioned before that the painting became the subject of an urban legend and a viral internet meme in February 2000 when it was posted for sale on eBay, along with a description implying that it was haunted. The Hands Resist Him was first displayed at the Fine Garden Gallery in Beverly Hills, California during the early 1970s. A one-man Stoneham show at the gallery, which included the piece, was reviewed by the art critics at the Los Angeles Times. During the show, the painting was purchased by actor John Marley, notable for his role as Jack Wolfs in The Godfather. Sometime after Marley's death, the painting was found at the site of an old brewery by an elderly California couple. The painting appeared on the auction website eBay in February 2000, and according to the seller, the aforementioned couple, the painting carried some form of curse. The eBay description made a series of claims that the painting was cursed or haunted. Included in those claims were that the characters in the painting moved during the night, and that they would sometimes leave the painting and enter the room in which it was being displayed. Also included with the listing were a series of photographs that were said to be evidence of an incident in which the female doll character threatened the male character with the gun that she was holding, causing him to attempt to leave the painting. A disclaimer was included with the listing absolving the seller from all liability if the painting was purchased. Of course, news of this listing was quickly spread by internet users who forwarded the link to their friends or wrote their own pages about it. And some people claimed that simply viewing the photos of the painting made them feel ill or have unpleasant experiences. Eventually, the auction page was viewed over 30,000 times, and after an initial bid of $199, the painting eventually received 30 bids and sold for $1,025. The buyer, Perception Gallery in Grand Rapids, Michigan, eventually contacted Bill Stoneham and related the unusual story of its auction on eBay and an acquisition of it. He reported being quite surprised by all the stories and strange interpretations of the images in the painting. According to the artist, the object presumed by the eBay sellers to be a gun is actually nothing more than a dry cell battery and a tangle of wires. Stoneham, however, recalled that both the owner of the gallery in which the painting was first displayed and the art critic who reviewed it died within 1 year of coming into contact with his painting. Stoneham would go on to create three more paintings as kind of a sequel to this, but you know, none of them have really gotten the attention that The Hands Resist Him have gotten. I myself have personally seen, you know, the painting in pictures and the pictures that depicted, you know, the supposedly strange occurrences going on with it. And, you know, and like I said earlier, that some viewers of these pictures reported feeling themselves get ill and feeling strange after viewing them. And that never happened to me. You know, it is a properly creepy painting, I will admit that. But, you know, as far as the stories about supernatural occurrences and the painting's characters moving around and even, you know, leaving the painting supposedly, I think it's all an urban legend and it all bullshit. But like I said in a previous episode, even with urban legends, there's always a tiny, tiny bit of truth to them. But they're usually so exaggerated that, you know, you can't tell what's fact or fiction. And I think that the stories behind this painting are just another case of that. This next object that I'm going to talk about is quite famous, and I'm sure that everyone has heard about it, even if they've never seen the Conjuring movies or the Annabelle movies, which are based on this object. And that, of course, dear listener, is the Annabelle doll. The real Annabelle looks quite different from the one that's portrayed in the movies. The real Annabelle is really pretty much just an old, beat-up Raggedy Ann doll. However, she has spent all her time since the mid-70s in the Warren's Basement Museum of the Occult. If you don't know who the Warrens were, they were Ed and Lorraine Warren, and they were basically paranormal investigators. Ed died years ago, I can't remember when, but Lorraine died just within, I believe it was the last 2 or 3 years. It was sometime shortly after, I believe, the last Annabelle movie, Annabelle Comes Home, was either done filming or shortly after it was released, she died. I can't remember. But like I said, the real Annabelle had spent all her time since the mid-70s in their museum. I'm kind of curious as to what had happened to all the supposedly haunted artifacts that the Warrens kept in their basement museum since Lorraine died. I've never really read anything that about what has happened to them, or if they're still in that basement with the new owners of the house, if there are new owners. I have no idea. But anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. But this allegedly evil doll has been blamed for demonic possession, a slew of violent attacks, and at least 2 near-death experiences in recent years. But just how much of Annabelle's story is true, and how much is just scary little stories and bullshit urban legends? The first of these infamous hauntings can allegedly be traced back to 1970, when Annabelle was brand new. The story was told to the Warrens by 2 young women, and was retold for years after by the Warrens themselves. As the story goes, the Annabelle doll had been a gift to a young nurse named Donna, or Deidre, depending on who was telling the story, from her mother for her 28th birthday. Donna, apparently thrilled with the gift, brought it back to her apartment that she shared with another young nurse named Angie. At first, the doll was an adorable accessory sitting on a sofa in the living room and greeting visitors with her colorful visage. However, before long, the 2 women began to notice that Annabelle seemed to move about the room of her own accord. Donna said that she would sit on the living room sofa before leaving for work, only to come home in the afternoon and find Annabelle in the bedroom with the door shut. Donna and Angie then started finding notes left throughout the apartment reading, "Help me." According to the women, the notes were written on parchment paper, which they did not even keep in their home. Also, Andy's boyfriend, known only as Lou, was in the apartment one afternoon while Donna was out and heard rustling in her room as if someone had broken in. Upon inspection, he found no sign of forced entry, but found the Annabelle doll lying face down on the ground. However, other versions of the story say he was attacked upon waking up from a nap. And when he suddenly felt a searing pain on his chest and looked down to find bloody claw marks running across it. 2 days later, the marks just kind of vanished without a trace, of course. Following this traumatic experience, the women invited a medium over to help solve their seemingly paranormal problem. The medium held a seance and told the women that the doll was inhabited by the spirit of a deceased 7-year-old named Annabelle Higgins, whose body had been found years earlier on the site where their apartment building had been built. The medium then claimed that the spirit was benevolent and simply wanted to be loved and cared for. The 2 young nurses reportedly felt bad for the spirit and consented to allow her to take up permanent residence in the doll. Eventually, in an attempt to rid their home of the Annabelle doll spirit, Donna and Angie called to an Donna and Angie called to a priest known as Father Hegan. Hegan contacted his superior, Father Cook, who alerted Ed and Lorraine Warren. As far as Ed and Lorraine Warren were concerned, the two young ladies' trouble truly started when they began believing that the doll deserved their sympathy. The Warrens believed that there was actually a demonic force in search of a human host within Annabelle and not a benevolent soul. They both went on to say, spirits do not possess inanimate objects like houses or toys, they possess people. An inhuman spirit can attach itself to a place or object, and this is what occurred in the Annabelle case. This spirit manipulated the doll and created the illusion of it being alive in order to get recognition. Truly, the spirit was not looking to stay attached to the doll, it was looking to possess a human host. Almost immediately, the Warrens noted what they believed were supposed signs of demonic possession, including teleportation, the doll moving on its own, materialization, the parchment paper notes, and the mark of the beast, which was supposedly shown in Lou's clawed chest. The Warrens subsequently ordered an exorcism of the apartment to be performed by Father Cook. Then they took Annabelle out of the apartment and to her final resting place in their occult museum in the hopes that her demonic reign would finally end. After removing Annabelle from Donna and Angie's apartment, the Warrens documented several other paranormal experiences involving the doll, the first just minutes after they took possession of her. After the exorcism of the nurse's apartment, the Warrens buckled Annabelle into the back seat of their car and vowed not to take the highway in case the doll had some kind of accident causing power over them and their vehicle. However, even the safer back roads proved too risky for the couple. On their way home, Lorraine claimed that the brakes either stalled or failed several times, resulting in a near disastrous crash. And this is kind of portrayed near the beginning of Annabelle Comes Home, when Ed and Lorraine's car breaks down in front of a cemetery because of the doll, supposedly. Lorraine claimed that as soon as Ed pulled holy water from his bag and doused the doll with it, the problem with the brakes disappeared. Upon arriving home, Ed and Lorraine placed the doll in Ed's study. There, they reported that the doll levitated and moved about the house. Even when placed in a locked office in an outer building, the Warrens claimed that she would turn up later inside the house. And that is when the Warrens decided to lock Annabelle up for good. They had a specially made glass and wood case constructed, upon which they inscribed the Lord's Prayer and St. Michael's Prayer. For the rest of his life, Ed would periodically say a binding prayer over the case, ensuring that the sinister spirit and doll remained good and trapped. And since being locked up, Annabelle hasn't moved again, though it is alleged that her spirit has found ways to reach out to the earthly plane. Once, a priest who was visiting the Warrens Museum picked up Annabelle and discounted her demonic abilities. Ed warned the priest about mocking Annabelle's demonic power, but the young priest laughed him off. On his way home, however, the priest was involved in a near-fatal crash that totaled his new car. And after the accident, he claimed to have seen Annabelle in his rearview mirror just before the accident. Years later, another visitor rapped on the glass of the Annabelle doll's case and laughed at how silly people were to believe in her. On his way home, he reportedly lost control of his motorcycle and crashed headlong into a tree, which killed him instantly, and his girlfriend just barely survived. The girlfriend claimed that at the time of the accident, the couple had been laughing about the Annabelle doll. Now, this is another case where I believe, personally, that none of this shit really happened the way the Warrens said it did. Especially since the names of the young priest and the motorcyclist were never given or divulged. And neither Donna or Angie, the two nurses who were Annabelle's first victims, ever came forward with their story. So basically all we have to go on to the supposed truth of all this was the Warrens' word. And since, you know, both of them are now dead, no one is ever really going to know the truth. I'm not sure if the two nurses are still alive or not. But like I said, you know, they've never come forward with their story. So, you know, something kind of reeks of bullshit. But, I mean, I could be wrong. Who the fuck knows? This third object that I'm going to talk about next, while it's not as well known as Annabelle, it has garnered its own low-budget movie franchise, which I talked a lot of shit about in last week's episode, and that is Robert the Doll. Robert is an allegedly haunted doll that is currently exhibited at the East Martello Museum in Key West, Florida. He was once owned by painter, author, and Key West resident Robert Jean Otto, who was described as eccentric and also belonged to a prominent Key West family. The doll was reportedly manufactured by the Steiff Company of Germany, purchased by Otto's grandfather while on a trip to Germany in 1904, and given to young Otto as a birthday gift. The doll's sailor suit was likely an outfit that Otto wore as a child, which is kind of weird, but whatever. the doll remains stored in the Otto family home at 534 Eastern Street in Key West, while Otto studied art in New York and Paris. Otto then married Annette Parker in Paris on May 3, 1930, and the couple returned to the Otto family home in Key West to live there until Otto died in 1974, and his wife died 2 years later. After their deaths, the Eden Street home containing the doll was sold to Myrtle Reuter, who owned it for 20 years, until the property was sold to the current owners, who operated it as a guest house. In 1994, the doll was donated to the East Martello Museum in Key West, Florida, where it became a popular tourist attraction. And so, you might be asking me, what's so spooky and haunted about that? Well, according to legend, the doll has supernatural abilities that allow it to move, change its facial expressions, and make giggling sounds. Some versions of the legend claim that a young girl of Bohemian descent gave Otto the doll as a gift or as quote-unquote retaliation for a wrongdoing. Other stories claim that the doll moved voodoo figurines around the room and was aware of what went on around him. Still, other legends claim that the doll vanished after Otto's house changed ownership a number of times after his death, or that young Otto triggered the doll's supernatural powers by blaming his childhood mishaps on the doll. According to local folklore, the doll has caused car accidents, broken bones, job loss, divorce, and a cornucopia of other misfortunes. And museum visitors supposedly experienced post-visit misfortunes for failing to respect Robert. As I stated in last week's episode, much like Annabelle, the doll that was used to represent Robert in the movies, it looks nothing like the real Robert doll. The real Robert doll actually kind of looks like a fucking potato in a sailor suit, in my opinion. But like Annabelle and the hands resist him, I think the majority of the stories about Robert and him and the doll itself supposedly being haunted are bullshit stories to garner tourist attention. I just don't really believe it. I mean, again, I can be wrong. But I just think it's all urban legends and stories meant to get tourists to come visit the doll and pay the museum their money. I mean, what better way to get attraction by people that are into the supernatural than say, hey, look, we have a haunted doll in this exhibit. Come see it. You know, and then, you know, kind of subliminally, I guess people kind of get the idea that misfortune that befalls them after seeing Robert in the museum is somehow the fault of the doll, just from, once again, hearing stories about know, misfortunes that have happened to other people supposedly, and shit like that. You know, I think it's all really just a scam. This next object is also pretty, well, not widely known, but is known about, and I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, so don't at me at it, about it. I'm going to pronounce it the way I think it is, but that is the Dubuque box. And now there is some controversy about the authenticity of this object and the story behind it, as someone has pretty much come forward and said that it's all bullshit, that they themselves made the story up about it. But that still, there's people that believe that it's a real thing. And once again, this was also, or the story behind it, was made into a movie directed by Sam Raimi, and that was The Possession. But anyway, back in 2001, Kevin Manis was out visiting yard sales looking for supplies for his furniture restoration business, a hole-in-the-wall shop located at the base of the Burnside Bridge in Portland, Oregon. The story goes that he purchased an old wine cabinet from the granddaughter of a recently deceased Holocaust survivor named Havela, who escaped Nazi-occupied Poland. Havela's parents, brothers, sisters, husband, two sons, and daughter were all killed. She, with other survivors, fled to Spain and lived there until the end of the war, when Havela, who lived to be 103, immigrated to the U.S. The wine cabinet was only one of three items she brought with her. As Manis paid for the cabinet, Havala's granddaughter said, "I see you bought the Dybbuk box." Manis wasn't familiar with the term. The granddaughter told him that her grandmother always kept it shut and out of reach because there was a Dybbuk in Jewish folklore. It is a evil, restless spirit that possesses the living inside it. The seller purportedly told Manis it was never to be opened, and if it was, bad things would happen. But, of course, Manis didn't heed her warning. Manis, who was in his mid-30s at the time, took the box back to the shop with plans to restore it and give it to his mother for her birthday. After opening the cabinet, he found a series of strange objects inside, two U.S. wheat pennies dating to 1925 and 1928, two locks of hair, a dried rosebud, a four-legged candlestick, a golden wine cup, and a granite sculpture inscribed with the Hebrew word Shalom. The Shema, a prayer considered to be one of the most important in Jewish culture, was carved on the back of the cabinet. Manis gave the box to his mother Ida on Halloween, and in a 2012 interview on the TV series Paranormal Witness, Ida describes feeling a cold breeze from the box as she opened its doors, then experiencing pure evil coming out. And she says that she immediately had a stroke after this occurred. Over the course of 2 years, a number of other mysterious events befell Manis and those around him. His sister got creeped out by the cabinet because the doors kept opening on their own. His brother and his sister-in-law complained of odd smells coming from the box, like cat piss and jasmine. Manis and his siblings suffered from the same recurring nightmares of an old woman with sunken eyes. And most disturbingly, he says, the brother of a store employee died by suicide shortly after visiting the shop and knocking the cabinet off the shelf. A couple years later, the worker himself also took his own life. Manis at one point tried to give the box to his then-girlfriend, but after keeping it for a time, she forced him to take it back. Then he began seeing what he later described as quote-unquote shadow things in his peripheral vision. Listing it on eBay in 2003, Manis, who has a background in writing, advertising, and entertainment, wrote a very long and detailed production description in which he dubs the item a Dybbuk box. Manis's eBay listing details about how he got it, the strange things that happened to him and his family afterwards, and why he wants to get rid of it. Toward the end of the description, he says, "Help me." Since then, the Dybbuk box has captured the popular imagination, becoming the stuff of internet legend and commerce, of course. You can buy Dybbuk boxes of all shapes and sizes on Etsy, eBay, and a website specifically dedicated to them, the Dybbuk Box Store. And you can even watch people open these things on fucking YouTube. In 2011, a subsequent owner of Manus's Box, Jason Hexton, released a book about the box. The director of the Museum of Osteopathic Medicine in Kirksville, Missouri, Hexton has studied American antiques and ancient artifacts for decades and was fascinated by the mysterious Wen cabinet. In his book, he details what befell him, everything from bleeding eyes to random choking attacks to, yes, reoccurring dreams of a creepy old woman in the first few months after buying the box. Of course, that fucking idiot, Zach Bagans, had to own a box of his own. So he bought one and even had an entire episode about it where that other idiot that he's friends with, Post Malone, supposedly got really creeped out about it after kind of touching it. Of course, like I alluded to earlier, there have been plenty of skeptics about this fucking thing over the years. In a 2019 column, Skeptical Inquirer magazine writer Kenny Biddle dismisses a haunted wine cabinet as a hoax. And as proof, Biddle posted a screenshot of a Facebook post from Manus dated October 24th, 2015, which reads, "I am the original creator of the story of the Dybbuk box, which appears as one of my eBay posts back in 2003. The idea that Dybbuk boxes have some kind of history prior to my story, and the idea that a Dybbuk box could contain anything other than a Dybbuk, along with any deviation to the type of contents I created to be found inside of a Dybbuk box, is laughable at best. How about this? If you or anyone else can find any reference to a Dybbuk box anywhere in history prior to my eBay post, I'll pay you $1 million and tattoo your name on my forehead." Now, once again, you know, and I'm sorry if this episode is shitting on people's beliefs or what they enjoy hearing about, but sorry, but I'm pretty sure this is just another fucking thing that was dreamt up to get money and attention from tourists. You know, and the fact that that fucking idiot Zach Bagans, who I can't fucking stand, was stupid enough to buy this fucking thing, is just further proof of how bullshit this story is. You know, it's just complete. I mean, I've seen unboxing, quote unquote, boxing videos of these supposedly haunted fucking things on YouTube, and it's all quite clearly bullshit. It's people overreacting, thinking they're looking like they're scared, but they're quite clearly not, and freaking out about things that aren't really fucking happening. You know, it's, once again, it's just another fucking urban legend that people want to believe is true, but more than likely isn't. With this next object, I'm going to start getting to the more lesser known and obscure haunted objects. And with that, we are going to start with the Busby Stoop Chair, or the Dead Man's Chair, which is an allegedly haunted oak chair that was cursed by the murderer Thomas Busby before his execution by hanging in 1702 in North Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. Due to the many deaths later attributed to people sitting in the chair, the landlord who owns it donated it to the Thirsk Museum. So, Thomas Busby was arrested, tried, and condemned to death after he murdered his father-in-law, Daniel Ati, in 1702. Ati and Busby were running a coin counterfeiting business, as well as other criminal enterprises, and they argued about the business, which ended with Busby killing Ati. One variation of the story has Busby cursing the chair whilst on his way to his execution, whereas another says that he was drunk in the chair when he was arrested and cursed it then. Busby was hung at Sandhut and Crossroads besides an inn, which later had its name changed to the Busby Stoop Inn. The site of the execution, opposite the pub on the A61 and A167 Crossroads, which is now a roundabout, was said to be haunted by Busby's ghost as well. Locals would claim that during the Second World War, Canadian airmen from the nearby base at Skipton-on-Swale went to the pub, and those who sat in a chair never returned from bombing missions over mainland Europe. In the 1970s, some fatal accidents were linked with the chair, and in 1978, the chair was ultimately hung from the ceiling of Thirsk Museum to prevent occupancy even by maintenance. A furniture historian examined the chair and found to have it machine turned. What the fuck? I just lost myself. A furniture historian examined the chair and found it to have machine tuned spindles, whereas 18th century chairs were made using a pole lathe. He dated the chair to 1840, 130 years after Busby's execution. Which pretty much calls bullshit and lays to rest the whole myth behind this chair. However, I will admit that there is some validity to the stories behind, you know, this supposedly haunted and cursed chair, as there are news articles talking about and explaining these actual deaths that did happen, and by all accounts that are given in these news stories, people that died did actually sit in Busby's chair. You know, but I guess take that with a grain of salt. I mean, I could be sitting in my own fucking bed and die in it, and then, you know, years later, people could say it's haunted because someone who was sleeping in it had a heart attack after sleeping in my bed the next day, or what the fuck ever. And, you know, that could have a logical explanation to it. It doesn't have to be something supernatural or paranormal or what the fuck ever, which could very well be the case in all the deaths that are reported to have been due to the sitting in this chair. But, you know, once again, I don't know. I wasn't fucking there. So who knows? But one thing is for sure, that the people in the museum are dead serious about nobody ever sitting in this chair. And that, dear listener, isn't the only haunted chair that I'm going to talk about this episode. And that next chair is the Devil's Rocking Chair. I'm going to straight up say right away that I sincerely doubt the validity behind the stories behind this, because once again, it's something that is owned by that fucking retard Zach Bagans, and I really don't buy anything that idiot fucking says. But anyway, this chair played a role in one of the most famous possession cases of all time, that of Arne Cheyenne Johnson, who claimed that he killed his landlord under demonic influence. But it wasn't only Arne. There was also the aspect of his fiancée's younger brother, the then 11-year-old David Glatzel, whose family received the rocking chair in the early 1950s. But in the summer of 1980, this previously unassuming piece of furniture would play a role in an extremely famous exorcism. And this was, of course, what The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It was based upon. According to Bagans, it's claimed that David started seeing visions of what he described as a man with black eyes, a thin face, with animal features, jagged teeth, pointed ears, horns, and hooves. He said that he had recurring nightmares of this figure and suffered unexplained injuries such as scratches and bruises. Sony said that he was seeing this devil figure during waking hours as well, invariably sitting in the family's rocking chair. While only David saw the demon sitting in the chair, the other family members claimed to have seen it moving on its own. When Iglesias consulted a priest about David's behavior, the boy is said to have begun hissing, spitting, speaking foreign languages, and quoting Paradise Lost, or so claimed Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens themselves were then called in to assist with the exorcism, and they claimed to have seen the chair moving on its own, with David sitting in it, disappearing and reappearing in other locations in the house, and also levitating. During the final exorcism, Arnie Johnson tells the demon to leave David and come into him. Then Johnson is possessed and murders his landlord. Then he goes on trial and becomes the first person to claim innocence for reasons of demonic possession, with the Warrens backing his claim. You know, and as I said, if this sounds familiar, it was described in great detail in The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Following the alleged possessions of David Glatzel and Arnie Johnson, the Glatzel family placed a spooky chair in storage. According to Baggins, however, that was enough to contain the evil of Sidon's own rocking chair. When the Glatzels moved into a new home, they took the rocking chair with them, and supposedly it caused no shortage of trouble. Anyone who sat in a chair, they say, began to suffer pain, such as backaches or sciatic nerve pain, some which were allegedly permanent or required surgery. As such, the Glatzels decided to finally rid themselves of the demonic chair. The chair made its way to the Warrens Museum, where it stayed until Baggins purchased it from the Warrens for $67,000 hours before Lorraine's death. Baggins then put the chair in his haunted museum in Las Vegas, which contains other items such as the Dybbuk box, which I mentioned before, a haunted doll, and parts of James Dean's car. Baggins claims that the chair still had its original cushion, on which are visible stains from the holy water and blessed oils that Ed Warren and the priests used during David's exorcism. Baggins reportedly has said that visitors to the museum have felt a menacing aura surrounding the chair even now, causing nightmares, tension, and arguments among people who come near it. The chair was also allegedly able to cause lights to turn off and doors to lock under their own power soon after it was brought to the museum. In 2019, Baggins would close the Devil's Rocking Chair display, claiming that the chair was causing too much supernatural trouble at the museum to be worth the risk. Baggins said that 6 different people suffered ill effects due to proximity to the item, all spontaneously bursting into uncontrollable weeping. Another guest supposedly collapsed on the stairs that are situated just above the rocking chair exhibit, and Baggins claims that the chair caused a chain of strange emotions within himself and a friend of his. Baggins and his friends were sitting in Baggins' home and felt an evil presence lurking between them, after which Baggins' dog began to growl, and Baggins lowered his head and began speaking strangely on the topic of God and the devil, all of which caused his friend to begin sobbing and run out of the house. However, which makes me think that all of this is bullshit. As of 2019, the Haunted Museum website prominently features a Devil's Rocking Chair as one of the exhibits available in the museum tour. So, if Baggins supposedly closed that exhibit down to all this supposed shit that was going on, why would he fucking reopen it? To me, that just further proves that this is all fucking bullshit. And if it's not, however, it just further makes me think that Baggins really is a fucking idiot. And if you couldn't tell, I can't stand that motherfucker. I really can't. I hate his show. I hate him. I hate everything about him and his show. It's all just fucking retarded. No, he makes me think of, or let me rephrase that, he makes me want to compare him to all these fucking supposed TV mediums that just fucking prey on those that don't know any better and think that these mediums can supposedly help them contact their loved ones when it's all just a fucking scam. That's how I look at fucking Zach Baggins. And we have yet another object that has a connection to Ed and Lorraine Warren and is supposedly what was the most haunted doll in the Warren's occult museum, and that is the Shadow Doll. And this doll is truly fucking terrifying and creepy looking if you see pictures of it. It has a gloomy and unpleasant look, and that's pretty much the purpose of its existence, since it was created during a ritual for diabolical purposes. If this doll appears in your dreams, it is more likely to be a nightmare. And the Shadow Doll is made up of human bones, and the teeth and nails are from animals. This cursed doll supposedly scatters its ill intentions in an unusual but no less terrifying way. The creators didn't make her as a gift, but created her to take photographs and send them to the people they wanted to harm. Anyone who would see the Shadow Doll's picture would have a curse fall on them. At first, when people used to receive the photo, they thought it was a joke and laughed it off. But once it was nighttime, however, they wished to have never gotten to sleep. The doll would supposedly appear into the victim's dreams, and the nightmares would be so terrifying that the person's heart would stop. It is not known how the Shadow Doll came into the Warren's hands, but a seller of ancient things sold the doll to some collectors who were affected from the first day they walked through the fucking door of their house with her. That day, the couple had nightmares where the doll appeared, and once they woke up, they were full of scratches. The second night, the same thing happened again, but this time, there weren't just scratches, but some marks like claws. After that, they decided to call the Warrens to take over the doll. The magic in this doll is supposedly so powerful that if she is destroyed, the spirits that were summoned during her creation will follow after those who did it, bringing misfortune and fear. Like I said, the story behind this kind of sounds like a fucking Freddy Krueger thing from A Nightmare on Elm Street, with the doll appearing in your fucking dreams, and that the nightmares would be so scary that it would make your fucking heart stop. Yeah, it all sounds kind of pretty fucking familiar. Even though, actually, I'm not sure when the Warrens got this doll into their possession, but if it was after, 1980, it's pretty clear where the story behind this came from, and which once again makes me call bullshit. But like I said, seeing pictures of this, I can see why people would have nightmares about it. It's really fucking creepy looking. I mean, I hate dolls to begin with, but this, I seriously, go look it up. Just look up the Shadow Doll on Google, and you'll see what I fucking mean. It truly is fucking terrifying looking. So I guess I could, just due to the doll's appearance, I guess I could see a little validity in, them saying that the doll would appear in nightmares and scare people so badly that their hearts would stop. But on the other hand, if these people are dead, how would they fucking know that the doll was in their fucking dreams? that part doesn't make sense at all to me. So yeah, I guess I really don't know how to feel about this story. And we are going to wrap this episode up with The Anguished Man, which is an oil painting that is known to be one of the most haunted objects in the world, alongside Annabelle the Doll and the Dybbuk Box. According to legend, the Anguished Man was created by an unknown artist who mixed the paint with his own blood. And shortly after the painting was finished, the unknown artist was said to have committed suicide. It is currently owned by one Sean Robinson from Cumbria, England. He inherited the Anguished Man from his grandmother, who had warned him that the painting was cursed. Although he was fascinated with the painting, Robinson had to keep it in the basement of the house because his wife didn't like it. In 2010, he finally removed the anguished man from the basement after a flooding and kept it in one of the bedrooms. Since then, Robinson and his family began experiencing strange activities around the house, such as seeing a shadowy figure of a man and hearing the sounds of whispering and crying. Further incidents occurred weeks later, haunting each member of the family. At nights, Robinson would wake up to see a dark, faceless figure standing in his bedroom, and his wife discovered a stranger lying on the bed next to her, leaving her traumatized. The incidents that really put the family in danger, however, was when the couple's son, Keenan, felt a presence push him down the stairs. In 2011, Robinson would upload a video on YouTube titled Ghostly Activity Caught on Tape, Haunted Painting, The Anguished Man, which gained over 1 million views. The video was recorded in one of the bedrooms for 8 hours, condensed down to nearly 3 minutes in the video, and contains footage of the door closing on its own while the painting is in the room. In addition to that, a loud banging sounds of scraping can be heard in this video. Since then, Robinson uploaded more videos, posting updates about the painting and capturing further supposed paranormal activity in the house, such as distorted sounds and a mysterious ghostly figure running past the camera. And it comes as no surprise that most people have questioned the authenticity of these videos. An example of this is shown in a 2012 episode of Discovery Channel's Weird or What, which was a show about unexplained mysteries, where a segment focused on the anguished man. A paranormal investigator named Mike St. Clair was interviewed in that segment, claiming that Robinson's videos were all bullshit. St. Clair explained that the strange movements could easily be replicated by pulling the door shut with a fishing rope to give the illusions that it is closing on its own and using an actor to run past the camera. Robinson also appeared in that episode to tell his story and briefly mentioned about the hoax rumors, stating, "A lot of people are skeptical, and I can understand that because I was a skeptic myself and I still am. But the footage is there for you to see it wasn't faked. There could be a perfectly reasonable explanation, but I haven't found one yet." And like most people that I mentioned, I myself question the realness and validity of this fucking story, as it very closely resembles another story about a painting. I can't remember what that painting was called, but the story about it went around a few years ago, but it was about a schizophrenic girl who ended up, who was a painter and who painted this one painting and ended up killing herself directly after she was finished, and which caused the painting to supposedly be haunted. Like I said, the stories are too similar for my liking, and you know, I've seen these videos on YouTube where that's with the supposed paranormal activity, and it's all quite obviously fake. Like you said, you can tell pretty clearly that someone's pulling the door shut with a string or something like that, and there's just someone banging around making noises, and it runs past the camera trying to look and act all creepy and spooky. But I mean, since when the fuck do ghosts run? They don't give a shit. Why the fuck would they run past a fucking camera? You know, it just lends to the fact that all the story behind this is all fucking bullshit, and it really doesn't help the dude's case one bit. So yeah, that just about wraps it up, guys. Like I said, you know, you can believe whatever you want. You don't have to agree with my thoughts on any of this. You know, people can believe what they want. Like I said, I'm not here to shit on your personal beliefs when it comes to things like this. I'm just saying that for me, a lot of it doesn't make sense. And I'm just still not a believer. I know a lot of us want to believe in life after death, but, you know, unfortunately, until that moment comes for us all, we're just not gonna know. As always, you can reach out to me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. Gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.